Welcome to the Daily Ben Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in at 4:30 every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, and I am joined today by Michael Morris and Marius Ruit. How are you guys this morning? Or this afternoon, rather.
I'm right. Very well. Yes.
Very well. Thanks, Nicholas.
Very good. All right, let us get into our first topic of today, and that is one of those topics that's always extremely contentious, and I recently, it seems that whenever I'm on air, I'm unable to pronounce anything, so I'm going to apologize in advance for the mess I'm about to make. But the city of Johannesburg has started a public participation process to have William Nicol Drive, which goes through a lot of Joburg, renamed after struggle veteran Winnie Madikizela Mandela. City Mayor Jeff Makubo said that actually the city had agreed to this over a year ago. And I looked it up, and it seems like the decision was actually made in 2018. That's when the Gauteng provincial government was informed of this decision. So that was actually during Mashaba's period of mayor of Johannesburg. And that the road would be renamed once there had been a public participation process that had given input on the decision. I thought it's just worth giving, most people know a bit about Winnie and her background, but it's worth, I think, giving some background on William Nicol, who the road is actually named after. In 1948, he was elected as the administrator of the Transvaal, and he retired on the in 1958. He believed in teaching education in a person's mother tongue and said that any education taught in a second language would hinder a person's growth and learning ability. Thus, he helped to translate the Bible with help from African religious leaders into Zulu. He opposed the National Party's Bantu education model and suggested a model with learning in mother tongue with English as a second language so that people could still communicate. So he was very much a sort of creature of the time, I think, but he was definitely not Hendrik Verwoerd. So I guess this raises the question, you know, should we really be naming things after, should we really be changing names right now? So Marius, let me start with you. Changing the name from William Nicol, a sort of relatively inoffensive character, to a very live wire person like Winnie, I mean, what's your feeling towards that?
Yeah, look, I understand the rationale behind name changes, but I think it's also important to we don't want to completely whitewash the past and say something like William Nicol, who was a fairly, he was probably a man of his time, but he seemed to be fairly progressive for somebody who worked for the apartheid government. And he did seem to actually care about the well-being of people who weren't the same color as him. So I think somebody like him, should we change names? I understand completely when people want to change names of roads like Verwoerd Drive or whatever, or we still have some place names in South Africa with the K word in it. I mean, those should be changed as a matter of haste. So I'm not sure why we have to focus on things like William Nicol and so on. So, and also I think this is kind of a bread and circuses type thing. The latest unemployment statistics just came out this morning, and we've seen it's an absolute train smash. So, and it's the government's just kind of, grabbing these really low-hanging fruits of changing names and so on, which is, these are easy things to do. You know, they just cost money and that's about it. And you go, you have your public participation process, even if, we know with this government, even 95% of people said, no, don't change your name. If they've made a decision, it will be changed. So these are all pretty much, nothing. They'll just for show anyway. And yeah, so it's, I think it's kind of inevitable. And I mean, I'm also at a point of not caring. The government must change whatever names it wants to. It's the only kind of thing it seems to be able to do at the moment. So if changing the names, it's not going to make a difference to somebody who's been unemployed for 2 or 3 years living in Berlin in the Eastern Cape, which is now going to have a name change, for example. So, go ahead and change the names. They don't want to make any of the hard decisions which will actually get the country working. So if they don't want, Go ahead and change the name. It's fine.
Yeah, I, what I'm more concerned about at the moment, I think, is the way that the more less offensive names are getting changed now after, and they've usually been renamed after very explicitly ANC type political figures. So in this case, for example, we're seeing William Nicol to Winnie. There's also, as you guys mentioned before the show, a move to change Cape Town International Airport, which is, of course, a completely neutral name, to be named after Winnie as well. So, Michael, what's your... Oh, sorry, Maurice, you want to reply to that?
Yeah, so, I mean, I remember when during the transition, a decision was made to, especially, I don't know if it was just with airports, but I remember with airports, like Jan Smuts, Jan Joburg was changed to Joburg International. Cape Town was DF Milan Airport, I think, that was changed to Cape Town International. Durban was Lubwata Airport. And they were changed to be explicitly neutral names and just be describe the city that they were in. And then Tambo was obviously changed. And just on the point on Winnie Mandela, she's obviously quite a divisive figure in South Africa. So you think, you know, maybe, I mean, she obviously did a lot in the struggle, but she's also, she tainted herself quite badly as well, especially towards the end. I mean, you know, accusations of murder and all kinds of things, embezzlement from the ANC Women's League and that kind of thing. And also the naming Cape Town National Airport after is also, I mean, she's not even from the Cape. It would make much more sense. There's many, you know, struggled people that are from the Cape, or you can name it after, you know, somebody who was part of the Khoisan resistance, the initial Dutch settlers or something like that. Klotoa, I think somebody's name was, I probably butchered the pronunciation. But, you know, it would make, I mean, if they want to change the name of Cape Town National Airport, for me, it would just make much more sense to change it to somebody who's actually from the Western Cape, or, you know, who's got strong links to the area, which Winnie Mandela doesn't.
So, Michael, on this point of sort of almost everything being renamed after mostly ANC people in a lot of cases, when it is named after someone, am I being unfair? Do you think that there's a sort of attempt by the ANC here to push their version of history on the country?
Yes, I certainly think so. I mean, I'm pretty much on the same page as Marius, in that I try to steel myself to kind of empathize with the desire for new symbolism and the cathartic rewards, is perhaps a good way of putting it, of overthrowing the old ones. But you can't shake the idea that much of it stems from an urge to distract public attention from what could well be called the failures of liberation, the continuing and in some cases worsening disadvantage, the economic crisis, the institutional weaknesses and so on, all of which in fact undermine South Africans generally, but especially those who had hoped for a better life post-1994. And from a heritage or historical point of view, I'm certainly not a fan of taking things away, if only because it's always a kind of deception. It's a kind of pretense that this didn't happen. And I think there are many thousands of opportunities to actually add to the record. And you've mentioned Krotoa and all kinds of interesting historical figures who have tended, I think, to be sidelined by the ANC's preponderance to acknowledge its own history. And even to incorporate ugly stuff into a sense of just how much has actually changed for the better. One of the things I've always felt is that in the case of street names and even some place names, a very good option would be to have a kind of standard plaque that can be used to annotate names and places that explains the person, explains the name, the context, why the name is contested today. And I think in this way, I mean, there's an opportunity to project an altogether more confident sense of, if you like, a liberated South Africa that's willing to acknowledge and live with its past. And it would certainly, of course, be much cheaper than going through the apparently very expensive business of changing the name and compelling people to, you know, others to change maps, to change addresses, change letterhead, and so on.
I'm just thinking, indeed. I just looked it up, but the name that came to mind was Dulcie September, and I had a look, and she's from Cape Town. I think that's somebody, if they wanted to change the name of Cape Town National, I think that's somebody that would, I mean, she was murdered, I think it was confirmed that she was murdered by the apartheid government in Paris. And she's somebody who was from the Cape and so on. I mean, if they do want to change Cape Town, I think that's you couldn't go too far wrong by naming the airport after her, for example.
Yeah.
I think we can see, though, that the ANC, I mean, think about how few things are named after Steve Biko. There's a couple of things here and there, but it's really, he really kind of gets brushed over, and I think that is very deliberately because he's not part of the ANC universe. Robert Sobukwe. So, you know, we've seen over and over again the ANC weaponizing history in very ugly ways. And I like Michael's suggestion of sort of enriching our history rather than just using it as a club to bash people with. Michael?
Absolutely. There was just another point I wanted to mention. A Daily Friend columnist, Paddy Clay, wrote just recently, a couple of weeks ago, about the whole question of museums. And one of the points she made was, you know, at the very point at which we going on this very expensive drive to tamper with the record, what we're also doing is actually ignoring the institutions which are preserving and trying to popularize our memory. And a good example is the District 6 Museum in Cape Town. You know, and we do need to remember the past, but we need to invest in that in a meaningful way. And museums are the obvious candidate for that kind of investment, which just isn't happening, as she pointed out.
Very well, very well said. Anyway, let us move on to our next topic for today. And this is a little bit of I got my order wrong. This is, of course, the exciting one in the U.S. political election, is that tonight is going to be the first debate between presidential candidates Donald Trump and presidential candidate Joe Biden. After beating Hillary Clinton, Trump basically said he famously did not do that much prep for those debates. Trump says that he's now going to continue this pattern. He's publicly said that, quote, sometimes you can go too much into that stuff. And by contrast, Joe Biden has been holding mock debate sessions with his senior advisors and has been sort of crafting a strategy. Trump is apparently thinking of bringing up Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, who is allegedly involved in corruption, according to Trump, as well as sexual harassment allegations that were made against Joe Biden in the 90s or this year by a woman called Tara Reid. Joe Biden's team says that they believe they're going to try and focus the debate on the coronavirus pandemic, racial unrest, and election integrity. I think will be an exciting debate, at least because both of these characters are well known for, shall we say, not always sticking to the script in politics, which can be a very dangerous thing in a debate. Maurice, who do you think is going to come out on top here? One of the issues that's been going into this debate is, as Trump and his campaign have made a big issue about how Joe Biden is old and senile and just not up to the job of presidency. I think Donald Trump said that he doesn't even know he's alive. So, have they made a mistake by perhaps lowering expectations? I mean, if everyone's expecting him to basically come out onto the stage and fall over, does that mean that as long as he can stay standing through the whole debate, he's going to do all right? What's your feeling on this?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I've seen different clips on the internet because, I mean, on social media, so partisan. People have a clip of Joe Biden fluffing his lines and it looks really bad. And then there'll be, you know, you'll see a clip a bit later where he answers a question, you know, very lucidly and goes in depth and he speaks very well off the cuff. So I think it's all Joe Biden's to lose here, really. I mean, as long as he doesn't, we've joked about this, as long as he doesn't start screaming and saying that he's covered in squirrels or that his legs are on fire, his arms are controlled by a pigeon in Catalonia, he's probably going to win the debate. You know, I think probably at this stage of the election, I'm not sure how many people's minds are going to be changed. I think there's maybe a couple of swing voters who, you know, if Joe Biden has a decent performance tonight, the people who are probably going to vote for him anyway. So I don't know how much, you know, there's probably a small proportion of people who are going to be swayed by the debate anyway. But I do think, I think this is Joe Biden's to lose. But yeah, I think it's going to be interesting. Neither Joe Biden nor Donald Trump are really you know, they're not going to be remembered as the greatest orators of the 21st century or anything like that. So, I mean, what will probably be quite exciting is little jabs that Donald Trump throws at Joe Biden. But I think, I mean, I'm actually, I'm a bit of a Biden fan, to be honest. So I think you'll probably be able to stand up to Donald Trump. But I think, yeah, I mean, and I think this is probably going to answer a lot of questions about Joe Biden's cognitive you know, capacity or whatever you want to call it. I mean, like we've seen a lot of people on the right saying that he's basically senile, but as I say, I've seen other clips where he seems like he's on top of things. So, I mean, Donald Trump also makes quite a few mistakes when he talks. So I don't think the right has got, or the Republicans have all that much, you know, room to talk when they criticize Joe Biden in the way he answers questions often.
Yeah, my sense of this, I think I agree that it is mostly Joe Biden's to lose. So we know from polling, and there's some people who dispute the accuracy of the polling, and there's some reasonable criticisms to be made of it. But I think generally speaking, most people I think it's sensible to trust the polling, at least generally. And that suggests that Joe Biden is ahead. And traditionally speaking, when you go into a debate ahead, you want to be a little bit more conservative. You don't want to go out and take risks. And you want to keep sort of things focused on your opponent. You don't want to say something too wacky. And in that sense, I really think that it is his to lose, is that if he does well, I reckon he's quite likely to win the election overall. He'll be able to maintain his lead. But equally, I think that a very public clash between the two, which is, and this will be really the first proper public clash between the two. This is going to be the first time that Donald Trump might be able to critically wound him if he can humiliate him in some way on the debate stage. Now, who knows what? I think Trump going a little bit too hard at Joe Biden's son or making him angry or just sort of annoying him might not work. But Morris?
I just want to say, I think that's one thing where South Africa could learn from. I think our politics would be enriched if we had these kinds of debates. And it always seems to be the ANC who's not keen on them and the current interim leader of the DA as well. So, but I do think these, you know, it might not change too many people's minds if you watch these debates, but I think it does give you an insight into the mind of a candidate or person you're considering voting for. And I mean, some people are opposed to debates in South Africa. I really think it's something we can learn from the Americans, I think.
Yeah, our colleague Gabriel Krauser has made a big deal about how there was a debate actually before the 1994 election, This was very healthy, and that since then we've been sort of strangled and stifled, and our public discourse has suffered a lot as a result. Michael, I know you're not a eager, keen watcher of American politics, but what's your sense of things? I mean, who do you think is going to come out on top if you were to go with your gut feeling? I think you're muted, Michael. There we go.
There we go. Sorry about that. I was about to say, I'm sure that was a Freudian aspect to my participation here, so muting myself on this topic. But I tend to be a bit at sea when it comes to U.S. elections, and partly because they've always seemed to be kind of impenetrably complex. But I think there's another truth, which I'd be interested to hear your views on it, is that I've often really felt that it doesn't really make much difference to the mighty and remarkably free United States who is actually sitting in the White House. But I'm sure to Washington watchers saying such a thing perhaps verges on sacrilege. But it certainly, I mean, it is quite a spectacle, and it's almost kind of part of the entertainment industry in a way. I mean, one is utterly intrigued by whatever Trump has to say, or even Joe Biden. And partly, I suppose, because it seems that so much is at stake in whatever they say or whatever they say they're going to do. But I just have this hunch that somehow it doesn't really matter that much. But perhaps I'm quite wrong. I'd be interested to hear your...
I think you're definitely... I would say it matters more perhaps than you suggest. But I do think that there is a very big problem actually in U.S. elections, that they overhype the importance of each individual election massively. Mm-hmm. You know, each election is said to be, I mean, this election we've seen commentators on both sides accuse the other of trying to plot a coup, which is not particularly good for democracy, I don't think. And there's an awful lot of hysteria that goes around these elections. But I do think that there will be consequences, particularly for the parties in the US, which will have ripples over the next decade. If Trump wins again, it's going to really solidify his kind of version of the Republican Party. He's going to brand himself very strongly on the Republican Party. Joe Biden, if he loses, he's going to probably destroy the moderate faction in the Democratic Party, because he is the candidate of the moderate part of the party. And if they lose, they're going to be very discredited, I think, especially against such a divisive figure as Trump. Mm-hmm. I don't know, Maurice, what's your sense?
I think so too. I think this is maybe one of the elections where the candidate is really going to make a big difference. I think it's that there's going to be consequences for, you know, for both sides, whether it's Joe Biden or Donald Trump winning. But I mean, I think we've had this discussion before where, you know, Joe Biden is not he's not going to save the US, but he's probably going to kind of put it back on the, you know, a bit more stable path. But I mean, there's also question marks around him and the kind of people he's surrounded himself with, especially Kamala Harris, and how much he's letting these kind of, you know, woke kind of people who buy into critical race theory into positions of power if he becomes president. So there's also big question marks over Joe Biden. But I also just want to say about Michael's point about it's part of the entertainment industry, really. We were talking about it earlier. It was Joe Rogan offered to have Joe Biden and Donald Trump onto his podcast. And I think, like I said, it would be a much more interesting and in-depth thing than, you know, just this thing where they give two minutes little sound bites and so on. And I think that would be give much better insight into both the candidates. And I think, who knows, maybe in the next election that's what we'll have when the, you know, candidates Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez versus Donald Trump Jr. or whoever's going to be running in 2024.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. The problem with this debate format is it is so much show business, which is one of the reasons why Trump did relatively well last time. It's a lot of, you know, remembering your lines, hitting your key points, showing up the right body language. You know, it's very inauthentic. And while I think authenticity can be overvalued in politics, I think in debates it is important, because it's a time when you get to really sort of see what a political candidate can actually do on their feet, where they stand on various issues. And it's a very illuminating thing. Debates are the one part of American election that a very large chunk of the population actually participates in terms of sort of watching it. Like, the conventions are not very important. That many people don't actually watch them anymore. So I think this is really one of the last chances that Trump has to turn this election around. That's my feeling anyway. Michael, any concluding thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I'd just be interested. Both of you know a great deal about it, but what's the sort of historical story of the importance of these elections? Is there a detectable shift in voter support immediately after people have watched these encounters?
Well, I think it depends a lot on who you ask. I think there's usually always at least some shift in the election. It's usually not decisive, but it can be a big help. Famously, when Walter Mondale lost to Ronald Reagan in 1984, he lost every single state except his home state of Minnesota. He said that there was a particular line during a debate when Ronald Reagan said that he wasn't going to use his opponent's youth and inexperience as a political weapon against him. Okay. It was that line that Walter Mondale, he said that when he heard it and he laughed, he knew that he had lost the election. So I think there are times when, especially psychologically, it can kind of subtly shift the way that people look at the candidates, and it sort of defines it in voters' minds. Because it is the one thing that's actually watched by a lot of people, American elections these days tend to be decided by a very small group of people who are generally referred to as low information voters, people who don't pay attention, because those are the only people who haven't made their minds up already, because they're not very ideological. And so the debate is usually the one thing in the entire election cycle that they do actually pay attention to vaguely, usually the first debate only, not the subsequent two. So it is a chance to shine, I think.
Interesting. A lot riding on it.
An interesting anecdote about American elections or American presidential debates for me is the famous 1961 between John Kennedy and Richard Nixon, where John Kennedy, he knew the power of showbiz, if you want to call it that. I mean, you know, his girlfriend was Marilyn Monroe, or his mistress was Marilyn Monroe. Mm-hmm. But so this was before television widespread. So only some people watching on TV and some watching the debates or listening to the debates on the radio. And Jack Kennedy went and he had his hair done and had makeup put on, where Richard Nixon decided, you know, that's not for him. He's a, you know, he's a man's man or whatever. And apparently he was a bit ill before the debate, so he didn't look great. But people who watched the debates on TV said Kennedy had won it easily, and people who'd listened on the radio said Nixon had won it easily. So it also just shows you the importance of, you know, kind of showbiz and appearance and so on.
Yeah.
And we'll see who's the better showman. I suspect it probably will be Trump. This is his business. This is what he's best at. But
Biden has also been in the politics business for longer than you or me have been alive, Nick.
No, that's true. That's true. I think Joe Biden was elected to the Senate in like 1970 something.
Yeah, really? 72, I think. Yeah.
Anyway, let's move on now just very briefly to a story that I think a lot of people are finding a little bit difficult to talk about in our business, because quite frankly, most people don't know much about this part of the world. And this is, of course, what seems to be a sort of undeclared war that's going on currently between the small countries of Armenia and Azerbaijan. So they are in the Caucasus between sort of Turkey, Iran, and Russia. So sort of quite contested part of the world. Azerbaijan has a lot of oil in it, so it's quite an important country. They're both former members of the USSR, the Soviet Union. And during the Soviet Union, my understanding is that Stalin messed with the borders of these countries, as he did in many places in the Soviet Union, including Central Asia. And he placed a part of Armenia he took a part of Armenia with a lot of ethnic Armenians and placed it under the control of Azerbaijan. And so when these two countries became independent in the 90s, there was a war between the two that ended with Azerbaijan losing control of the region, but the international order still recognizes that part as actually belonging to Azerbaijan, even though it's not under the government's control. So it seems as though, with the backing of Turkey in the past few days, the Azerbaijani army has attacked this part of their own country to try and bring it back under government control. And the Armenian separatists there have fought back, and the Armenian government has backed them. And it looks like now this is turning into a sort of a great power clash, because Russia is a big friend of Armenia and Turkey is a big friend of Azerbaijan. Marius, very briefly, what's your sort of sense of how this thing is going?
Sure. I mean, these things always seem to end up in a stalemate there in between Armenia and Azerbaijan. And they were actually at clashes in July, the two countries, and it wasn't over this breakaway region in Nagorno-Karabakh. It was for another reason. And about 20-odd people were killed in these clashes. There was no infantry. This was in July. This was just the artillery and tanks and so on. So this seems to be a bit of an escalation. And apparently Armenia and Nagorno-Karabakh have both both put their countries under martial law and have mobilized all male citizens to get involved. And Azerbaijan's also placed itself under martial law. So things seem to be getting quite heated there. But I think what we'll have to watch is, as you say, is Russia is backing Armenia, but they're apparently also sort of friends with Azerbaijan, so it makes it a bit complicated. And Turkey's obviously a big friend of Azerbaijan. The Azerbaijanis are apparently kind of ethnic brethren of the Turks. They come from the same like kind of Turkic ethnic group. So they also, and obviously they're also both Muslim majority states, so that's also part of it. So well, I think it's interesting. We'll have to keep an eye on it. And it's there's also, I mean, it's an important geopolitical region. I mean, there's lots of pipelines that go through there towards Europe and so on. So it's something we need to watch. But just as an aside, I was actually supposed to be in Armenia within the next couple of days. I was going to be on holiday in Turkey and then go to Armenia. So maybe there's something I should thank COVID for, because I don't fancy having a beer in a cafe there in Yerevan in Armenia while having to wear a bulletproof vest and a helmet. And maybe, who knows, maybe I'd been shanghaied into the Armenian army and been sent to the front line or something.
somehow can't see it, but it is a beautiful sight to consider. Michael, do you have any thoughts on this? I think you are muted, so just unmute yourself.
I think Michael's having, there we go.
Right.
I mean, you know, once again, the kind of horror of nationalism It doesn't take much, I think, to kind of stimulate people into seeing themselves as being members of a particular kind of polity, a particular geography which has to be defended to the death and so on. And the winners in these things are usually only the arms traders, really. So, a complex situation. People do have a sense of who they are and a sense of their national belonging, but it's always tragic, I think, when it's allowed to develop to an extent where you have two armies facing one another, and the costs are always, needless.
Indeed, and it's even made worse when you have great powers meddling in things, because then it has exactly. the potential to get even worse. But we will see now. This is part of an ongoing struggle between Turkey and Russia that's now in three countries, because the Azerbaijan-Armenia conflict, Russia and Turkey are struggling against each other to some degree. Libya, the two different sides of the civil war there are backed by Turkey and Russia, respectively. And Syria as well has turned into a Russian versus Turkish conflict as well. So it looks like there's a lot of developing problems from this great power clash, and I wonder if it will come to a head in the next couple of years.
Yeah. Sort of kind of proxy combats, yeah.
Yeah, it's a sort of mini Cold War being fought under everyone's noses. Anyway, we will end it there. But thank you very much for listening, everyone. If you want to support the work that the IRR does and our analysis, research, and all that kind of thing, please go to the IRR website, irr.org.za, click the Join Us button, and sign up to become a friend. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll catch you tomorrow on The Daily Fin Show. Thanks, everyone.